Wormwood. You seem to be doing very little good at the present. The use of your patient's love to distract his mind from the enemy is, of course, obvious. But you reveal what poor use you are making of it when you say that the whole question of distraction and his wandering mind has become one of the chief subjects of his prayers. That means you have largely failed. When this or any other distraction crosses his mind, you ought to encourage him to thrust it away by sheer willpower and to try to continue the normal prayer as if nothing had happened. Once he accepts the distraction as his present problem and lays that before the enemy and goes so far as to make it the main theme of his prayers and his endeavors, then, so far from doing good, you have done harm. Anything, even a sin which has the total effect of moving him close up to the enemy, works against us in the long run. A promising line is the following. Now that he is in love, a new idea of earthly happiness has arisen in his mind, and hence a new urgency in his purely petitionary prayers about this war and other such matters. Now is the time for raising intellectual difficulties about petitionary prayers of that sort. False spirituality is always to be encouraged. Allow him to believe that only the spiritually immature need to petition the enemy for their needs, while the spiritually mature are satisfied to pray for the essentials like daily bread or whatnot. Never let him realize that even a prayer for daily bread is as petitionary as any other. As for answered prayer, don't forget to use the heads I win, tails you lose argument. If the thing he prays for doesn't happen, then that is one more proof that petitionary prayers don't work. If it does happen, he will, of course, be able to see some of the physical causes which led up to it and dismiss it with the idea that it would have happened anyway. Thus, a granted prayer becomes just as good a proof as a denied one that prayers are ineffective. You, being a spirit, will find it difficult to understand how he gets into this confusion. But you must remember that he takes time for an ultimate reality. He supposes that the enemy, like himself, sees some things as present, remembers other things as past, and anticipates others as future. Or even if he believes the enemy does not see things that way, in his heart of hearts he doesn't really believe that the enemy sees things as they really are. If you try to explain to him that men's prayers today are one of the innumerable coordinates with which the enemy harmonizes the events of tomorrow, he would complain that the enemy always knew men were going to make those prayers, and if so, they did not pray freely but were predestined to do so. What he ought to say, of course, is obvious to us. That the problem of coordinating particular events to the particular prayers is only a problem for creatures trapped in time, and who must experience that time as a series of successive events. The enemy is unfettered by that constraint and sees his creation operate at every point of space and time. Why he leaves room for their free will in his creation is the problem of problems, the secret behind the enemy's nonsense about love. How it does so is no problem at all, for the enemy does not foresee the humans making their free contributions in a future, but sees them doing so in his unbounded now. And obviously, to watch a man doing something is not to make him do it. Some meddlesome human writers in ancient times have attempted to let this secret out, but we have neutralized them in this modern age by inculcating the historical point of view. The historical point of view, you should know, means that when a modern man is presented with any statement by an ancient author, he now asks, Who influenced the ancient writer, and how far the statement is consistent with what he said in other books? And what phase in the writer's development or in the general history of thought it illustrates? And how it affects later writers, and how often it has been misunderstood, and what the general course of criticism on it has been for the last 10 years. The one question we've persuaded him not to ask is whether what the ancient writers have written is true. Imagine that, to regard the ancient writer as a possible source of knowledge. To believe that what he said could possibly improve your thoughts or your behavior, this would be rejected as unutterably simple-minded. Thanks be to our father and the historical point of view. Great scholars are now as little nourished by the past as the most ignorant school students who believe that history is bunk. Your affectionate uncle, Screwtape.